This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It doesn't get us all the way to solving climate change, but it points the way forward in an otherwise very broken political system. And it feels like columnists like Brett Stevens, they keep investing in the brokenness and not investing in how to actually do better.
Disinformation. It sometimes manifests in theatrical shows of ignorance, like senior Republican Senator James Inhofe bringing a snowball to the Senate floor as evidence that global warming is a hoax, or the persistent denial coming out of the ill-informed head of the current president that Harvey and Irma are unrelated to climate change. But where does the disinformation start? Sometimes the seeds of willfully inaccurate right-wing talking points are planted by more mainstream conservative thinkers, like George Will, Rich Lowry, Peggy Noonan, or the latest star of the right-wing elite, New York Times opinion columnist Brett Stevens. Under cloak of sophisticated language, these opinion columnists bury grains in the fertile right-wing psyche that grow into dangerously thorny vines of falsehood. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with DC-based science communicator Aaron Huertas to discuss what disinformation Brett Stevens has sown lately regarding the climate. We talk about Stevens' disregard for solutions that could fight climate change, examine the weaknesses in his research, and ponder what motivates him to reach his simplistic and misleading conclusions. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Aaron Huertas. He is a science communicator and a consultant. His company is Science Communication Media. Aaron, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why don't you first give our listeners an idea of your background? What is science communication media all about?
Yeah, I've been living and working in D.C. for about 15 years now, and I've always been interested in science ever since I was a kid. My uncle took me to the Tokamak Fusion Test Lab in Princeton, New Jersey, when I was in middle school, and that was the first time I met working scientists. And I was really surprised to learn at the end of that tour that was a lab that received a lot of federal money. And our tour guide even told us, please tell your member of Congress what a great time you had today at the Fusion Lab, because we are running out of our funding. So that was a big wake-up call for me that the science that I was into was actually related to all the political discussions my family was having around the dinner table. And I've always liked communications. I've always liked politics and public policy. So that's what I've been doing, helping scientists interact with the political system, everything from talking to the media to giving testimony to meeting with community groups.
Now let's turn to how we met, which is an interesting thread that you had on Twitter, replying to New York Times op-ed columnist Brett Stevens, who we discussed when he was first hired. We had a psychologist on who I know who is friendly with Brett and thought that this hiring was a good move because he is a reasonable conservative and he will present a clear-eyed case for conservative values that liberals who read the New York Times otherwise may not have been exposed to. That was basically the thesis, and we all need to kind of understand each other if we're going to move forward in this seemingly intractable situation we're in right now. You responded to a recent op-ed where he dips his toe into the climate change world again. He had one early in his hiring at the Times. Why don't you first kind of give us an overview of Stevens' latest piece, if you will?
Yeah, so Stevens' chief argument is that the richer a society gets, the easier it is for that society to deal with natural disasters, including natural disasters that are exacerbated by climate change. And he presents this as if it somehow contradicts what climate activists or green groups or really any knowledgeable person who's been working on climate policy for any amount of time would say, and it's not a contradiction. It's just part of the bigger picture of climate policy and wrapping our heads around this big problem that we face. It's also the case that, you know, there's an upper limit to how much any society can adapt to climate change. At a certain point, it can get so hot outside that people can't live and work with any amount of exposure outdoors when the heat index gets high enough. An underwater city, no matter how rich it is, right? It's you can't assume that a city that gets flooded out every year is going to remain economically productive or, quote, rich, unquote, in perpetuity. So it's really a ham-fisted way to approach the climate debate, and it's one that doesn't address the core issues that actually make climate change so worrisome to scientists. One being the carbon dioxide keeps accumulating in the atmosphere. You have to stop that at some point. And two, the climate change that we're locking in is functionally permanent because it takes thousands of years for that carbon dioxide that's trapping all that heat to sink back into the oceans and get absorbed back into the Earth system.
And there's an economic component to this as well, one that we've discussed on the show in the past, which is he's kind of the mindset that all we need to do is keep growing these economies and then we can kind of work around the realities of climate change. And so conservatives will look at him and say, well, look, he's actually accepting climate science, so problem solved. But there's also some realities that I think are driving economic policy in this country right now, which is this kowtowing to the temple of endless growth, and it's unrealistic, isn't it?
Yeah, I really see it more as competition between zero emissions clean energy sources and the fossil fuel economy, and that's really where climate change comes in. You know, you can have economic growth in clean energy. We've seen a lot of that over the past several years. That's been one of the great good news stories in climate, is this explosive growth in solar jobs, which outperform fossil fuel jobs now. And that's with solar comprising just about 1% of energy production in the United States. So that is a good news economic story. And I think realistically, given the speed with which we need to solve the problem, the economic growth model is where we're going to be at. I would like to see that growth in clean energy, not in fossil fuel energy. And that's what solves climate change. And that was what was just absolutely missing from Bret Stephens' column. And it was another thing that was missing was the fact that renewable energy is really flexible and can actually help us respond to natural disasters in ways that baseload energy can't. So, you know, that there's a lot of very interesting, very productive things that somebody like Bret Stephens can say about climate change and climate policy, but he doesn't say that. He's just been using his column to attack climate solutions, and that's actually not helpful at all.
Yes, he's not a climate science denier anymore, technically, but he's a climate solutions denier, I say.
Yeah, and I think someone who just hasn't seriously grappled with climate science or its implications or how people who actually work on this think about it. He just approaches it in a really simplistic way that I think shows he has not honestly engaged with his critics since, not only since he got this post at the New York Times, but, you know, the first time I ran into Bret Stephens was in 2009, and he wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal that literally said, follow the money. And he said that climate change researchers have to believe in global warming, otherwise they don't get their grant money. And he compared them to priests who have to believe in the existence of God. And, you know, 2009 was not a very long time ago, and that's what he says his views were then. Who knows? They might still be his views now, but he can't get away with saying stuff like that in the New York Times. So instead, he makes these other arguments. And Mike Mann, a climate scientist who's probably faced more attacks from climate deniers than any other scientists working today, he calls it the ladder of denial. So you might start off with these conspiracy theories or saying that, oh, the CO2 is not from fossil fuels or saying the temperatures aren't rising. And you have to keep climbing up the ladder because you can only get away with so much if you're part of the discourse in society. So by the time you get to the top of that ladder, you wind up saying stuff like Bret Stephens is saying, which is, oh, the science isn't good enough to justify policy action. And the reality is he just hasn't found any policy action he's comfortable endorsing. And that's where he should invest his time, is figuring out, okay, what kind of climate policy can I live with? Let me promote that, not let me criticize every attempt someone has made to address climate change in society.
Speaking of Bret Stephens and climbing up the climate change ladder, a lot of his ideas may sound harebrained to frequent Sea Change Radio listeners or environmentalists, but anybody who's debated conservative friends or tuned into Fox News in the last few years has noticed that these kind of ideas, like the example you give that the scientists who are reporting on climate change have a financial incentive, these ideas don't just lay fallow. They get picked up by millions of people, and and turned into talking points. I've heard this talking point in many different areas. There's reason to be suspicious about X, Y, or Z, and it's pretty insidious. So when he says these things innocently, and now it actually can have a ripple effect across many different mediums, you're more in tune with not only the science community, but the anti-science community. Maybe you can kind of give an idea of how his ideas reverberate, and not just him, but how the food chain kind of feeds upon itself in these bubbles.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, I think it's kind of an ecosystem, right? So you can picture climate denial as maybe a fetid swamp. Not that I have anything against swamps or wetlands, but a fetid swamp where all this bad stuff comes from. So climate denial world is really weird. There's obviously a lot of fossil fuel money that goes into it. But you also have to keep in mind, for a lot of people who professionally work in climate denial, it's kind of a backwater of the conservative movement. If you're somebody who's really into conservative policy, the stuff you might be into are, you know, government regulation, writ large, tax policy. You might be into abortion issues. So you might be into free speech issues. The type of people who say, you know what, I'm really mad at clean air regulations. I think somebody has to go stick up for the coal industry and the fossil fuel companies. Those are the type of folks who gravitate into climate denial world and come up with this stuff. So you have your professional folks. You also have your wacky conspiracy theorists online who I compare to grifters. So, you know, folks like Alex Jones stick out. You know, folks like Rush Limbaugh stick out. And they just spread abject conspiracy theories about climate science. And that's really infected our politics in a bad way. And we're at the point now where, you know, it's really shocking when you sit back and think about it. Lamar Smith, the Republican head of the House Science Committee, has written columns for Breitbart about why we shouldn't trust climate scientists. That's really disturbing. That's not something I think any of us would have predicted 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But that sort of conspiratorial thinking, this abject climate denial, it's just grown and it's festered. And now we're the only country on earth that has a head of state who denies climate change. And that's a really scary thing.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Aaron Huertas. He's a science communicator. So Aaron, what's in it for the Bret Stevenses of the world? I imagine he's not being paid by fossil fuel companies in a direct way. And he seems to be an intellectual. He's kind of the successor to George Will in many ways. What's in it for him? Is he just grappling with these issues on his own without actually doing a ton of research? What do you think motivates him to write these kind of columns?
Yeah, it's so hard to say. You know, I think from the perspective of the New York Times, they like having the so-called center-right voices because they believe in the discourse and presenting both sides. And unfortunately, because the climate debate is so broken, we don't really have two sides to the climate debate. We don't have liberal ideas for addressing climate change versus conservative ideas for addressing climate change. We just have liberals desperately wishing for climate policy and working to try to figure this stuff out at the local level and at the state level and at the federal level when they're in power. And we have conservatives trying to stop them. It's not the type of political debate that we're taught to expect in civics class when we're growing up, right? It's the type of broken, hyperpolarized debates that we're living through now. And when one side of the debate says the science isn't real and I don't want any of these policies and everything you say is a terrible idea, that's not a real debate. That's just climate denial.
But to his credit, Stevens does not engage in that as in an outright way. But what he does is a lot more mealy-mouthed in some ways. Maybe we can get into the weeds on this article. We mentioned how he's just touting that growth is kind of the answer, but he's using Hurricane Harvey and Houston as kind of the launching pad for his ideas, that Look, when a major flood happens in Bangladesh, you got 100,000 people dying. And in Houston, you know, only 60 people died. So the rich people have it right. And so Bangladesh, you better start making some money so you can survive these natural disasters that inevitably are going to accelerate. Is that a fair synopsis of what he's saying, you think?
Yeah, and I think the biggest contrast that we've seen to how Bret Stephens thinks about this is also in the New York Times, and it was a column by Nick Kristof, essentially on the same exact topic.
Right.
The difference is that Kristof has actually spent a ton of time in developing countries thinking about how we end poverty and how we can protect these countries and the people who live in them from climate change. And you know what? If there were some pathway for everyone in Bangladesh to get as rich as everyone in Houston in the next 30 years, that'd be a great discussion. But one of the scariest things about climate change is that because of the rapidity with which the climate is changing, because of how bad these floods are getting, you're just looking at a situation where people are going to get driven from their homes and become refugees, right? And that's the point at which climate change is a humanitarian concern. It's a security concern. And, you know, for someone who's a columnist at the New York Times, I would like to see their head there, not them saying, well, we can just kind of wish this problem away through economic growth, because we really can't.
And it's a very hazy solution, right? Economic growth.
What kind of growth? Is it, if it's fossil fuel growth, you just made the problem worse. Now what?
Exactly. And that's the catch-22, because that's kind of what they're saying is we need short-term economic growth. And in the short term, you could at least make the argument then in the next year or two that there is a short-term solution economically by focusing more on fracking. But long-term, there's not a really good case for that economically, and certainly not when you're looking at the externalities and the effects that it would have on our environment.
Yeah, and I mean, the simple solution to all of this is to just look at what's happening in clean energy. The prices keep falling, you know, the jobs in clean energy keep expanding. A lot of the smart money is increasingly going to fund clean energy projects and get those on the grid instead of fossil fuel projects. So, you know, we're looking at a huge opportunity to actually get to something that's a lot closer to 100% renewable clean energy system that can be better for our communities, that can be producing cleaner air, that can employ more people, that can produce more revenue for people locally. And we're actually seeing a big divide within the sort of corporate lobbying world itself, where the fossil fuel companies are the ones who are increasingly isolated because their economic model is not changing that much. Meanwhile, the clean energy sources, and I would include batteries in that too, which can also help with electrification of vehicles, all that stuff keeps getting cheaper and cheaper. So if you look at the writing on the wall, we can do this transition to a clean energy future. I'd love to see liberals and conservatives debating how to get there, not debating whether or not climate change is real.
And sticking with Stevens, so he's not offering any solutions. When pressed, he kind of makes these vague overtures towards more research. But then he also, as you say, plays the refs. Why don't you explain?
Yeah. So the initial response to Stevens getting hired at the New York Times was a lot of blowback, not just from climate activists, but really the first big piece of criticism came from a German climate scientist named Stefan Rahmstorf. And he wrote a note publicly to the New York Times saying, you know, I've read this guy's stuff at the Wall Street Journal for many years. You know, I know he spreads misinformation about the science I've spent my entire professional career working on. I'm withdrawing my subscription. I'm no longer going to pay for my New York Times subscription. I'm done. And that went viral. It's not something that Stevens has really responded to directly, the substantive point Stefan Rahmstorf made. So I think that's a big point against him. And he never really responded to the scientists who pointed out why he's been so wrong about climate change over the years. But because the argument was around canceling a subscription, I think for a lot of reporters and people who work in media, they felt like, oh, that's out of bounds. They're not hearing this guy out. You know, that this is a little bit too far. So Stevens was able to use that to say, hey, I'm being treated unfairly by the climate community and by these scientists. They're not listening to me. I'm here to have, you know, a productive debate. And I think that's a really appealing argument to a lot of media watchers and a lot of people who work in media. Yet at the same time, a lot of people were saying very mean stuff to him on Twitter. And I think a lot of journalists get harassed online on Twitter a lot. So they were sympathetic toward that. But I also think that's just kind of like how Twitter is when you're talking about public policy issues and politics.
Didn't he actually admit to kind of handing over his Twitter account to some assistants at the Times?
The New York Times is literally paying somebody to handle Bret Stephens' Twitter for him because he couldn't handle the criticism that he was getting. And, like, you know, for somebody to say, I'm here to have a public debate and, you know, you come debate me, I don't think that's what he really wants. I think he wants his bad ideas to be treated as if they're very good, interesting ideas, and he can't take the heat. And if he's really not willing to put in the work to have an interesting opinion about climate policy, maybe don't write about climate policy. Maybe go write about something else. And even within Twitter itself, he responded to an account that wasn't from a scientist or a climate activist. It was somebody with a dog and cat avatar with 289 followers. And that was his idea of a response.
I only have a few more than that, so let's not disparage those with 289 followers.
But your avatar is you.
Okay, fair enough.
And then he did a response to a Facebook chat with some of the New York Times readers, responded to a few arguments there, but again, was not engaging with climate policy experts or scientists in a public way. He wasn't really having the debate. He was still putting himself up on this high perch of, I am a New York Times columnist and everyone must take me very seriously. And the last time he really engaged on this, it was as his colleague Gail Collins conducted an interview with him, which was really good, where she really pressed him on climate policy. And the furthest he was able to go was to say, well, I have concerns about a carbon tax and I'm going to learn more. And there's no evidence that he has learned more. And I think it's just an excuse, right? He still can't find climate policy that he actually supports. And that's really the problem that the Republican Party has at the national level when it comes to climate policy. They're not trying to figure out what their climate policy is going to be. It's easier to just have all these excuses from it's a hoax to I'm not a scientist to I'm going to criticize everything that's out there. And it's a big problem. It's the main thing that is holding climate policy back in the United States.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to science communicator Aaron Huertas. Aaron, so you give some examples of what Stephens might want to engage in that would be more productive, notably reforming our broken flood insurance system. I was intrigued by this. What would a hypothetical Bret Stephens piece about our broken flood insurance system look like?
Yeah, I think this is when we need to move beyond fact-checking and get into what I call integrity checking. What would a columnist with integrity do in this situation if they really wanted to have a debate about climate policies? And I think in Bret Stephens' case, some great folks for him to talk to are the Niskanen Center and the R Street Institute and the Energy and Enterprise Institute. And these are all libertarian to right-leaning think tanks that are actually invested in having debates around climate solutions. And if you put all those folks in a room together and have them sit down with Greenpeace, they're not going to agree about everything, but there's a couple things that they can agree on. The first thing is that climate change is real. It's caused by burning fossil fuels and destroying tropical forests, and that it presents serious problems and risks for society that we have to address. And one particular area where those groups have been able to work with green groups, to work with climate scientists, and work with experts, experts has been reforming the federal flood insurance system and looking at properties that are going to keep getting flooded out over and over and over and over again, and thinking to ourselves, okay, you know, how do we stop incentivizing rebuilding in these places that we know are going to keep flooding as sea levels rise? So that's something that Congress passed and then walked back on. The Obama administration passed some rules that would change how we do future infrastructure investments based on what future flooding scenarios look like. The Trump administration backed off of those right before all these hurricanes started forming. So, you know, a focus on those kind of policies, that's something that would be useful. And it's not, it doesn't get us all the way to solving climate change, but it points the way forward in an otherwise very broken political system. And it feels like columnists like Brett Stevens, they keep investing in the brokenness and not investing in how to actually do better.
The history of conservative columnists, we can trace it back to William F. Buckley and Bill Sapphire, but I feel that there's a common thread from the Peggy Noonans, the George Wills, and Sapphire, and now Stevens, is that they are elite thinkers in that they went to the right schools, they write very well, a lot of clever alliteration and references to historical figures, but they seem to be kind of what conservatism has rebelled against the last couple decades, this the liberal elite. They're the conservative elite, but they don't actually have any working knowledge and background in the things that they opine about generally.
Yeah, I call it having thinky thoughts, and that's what he gets paid for. And I look at a lot of those columnists and I think to myself, you know, I've worked on climate policy for more than a decade now, and I probably don't have well-formed opinions about healthcare. I probably don't have well-formed opinions about Syria. I have well-formed opinions about the energy system and about climate, but that's because I've put in the work and the time. And I think recognizing the limits of their knowledge is important. And I also think you're exactly right about how the power dynamic has shifted. A lot of the never-Trump conservative intellectual elites are on the outs as far as power is concerned in their party. And I don't see that they have a game plan to get that power back. And in fact, I see our political system writ large becoming much, much more populist and much, much less interested in sort of elite consensus beltway media around public policy issues. Because the elite consensus in the beltway on climate change right now is that it's very hard and we're not going to do anything about it. Or what we're going to do is going to be very limited and very circumscribed. Like the best thing that's happened in climate policy in the past couple of years, as far as Congress is concerned, is some tax credits got extended for wind and solar in exchange for allowing the export oil exports that were previously not allowed. So that sort of back and forth, it's not going to get us close enough to actually solving climate change.
So people who are listening who feel a little helpless and frustrated with the situation, they don't necessarily need to be. You're an activist and have done some important work to getting people behind the right issues and putting their money and their hard work behind it. What makes you hopeful that we're going to get beyond these dark days?
Well, the amount of grassroots energy that we've seen since the election and since Trump's inauguration has been incredible. I've been blown away by it. I've been calling it a giant democracy party. And when I look at politics right now, the New York Times opinion page isn't going to solve climate change for us. Brett Stevens definitely is not going to solve climate change for us. So I've been encouraging people to get involved with groups like 350.org, with groups like the League of Conservation Voters, with groups like Next Gen America, which used to be called Next Gen Climate, which I've worked for. Hit the ground. Talk to your neighbors. Get organized. Help organize other people. Help other people vote. Ultimately, that is where political power comes from. It comes from our communities, not from the Beltway, not from the elite media. And I think more and more people are seeing that, getting involved locally, and I think we could really see a wave election in this next election coming up in the midterms. That could be a really exciting thing, and that's where I'm putting a lot more of my time and my energy too.
Aaron Huertas, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Galactic, The Rolling Stones, and Levon Helm.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.